WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org. From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Monday, the New York Times ran a couple of photos alongside its story on the Iran-Mexico World Cup match. In one of them, a protester held up a sign that read, "Israel is on the map to stay." It was an obvious reference to Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's infamous remark at an anti-Zionist conference last October that Israel, quote, "should be wiped off the map." That utterance, since quoted in the media thousands of times, has been read as an ominous portent of Iran's nuclear aspirations. But is that, in fact, what he said? A debate over the translation was sparked by an email made public by University of Michigan professor and Middle East specialist Juan Cole. The New York Times, which first ran the quote in a story by reporter Nazila Fati, examined the dispute. Actually, Deputy Foreign Editor Ethan Bronner examined it, and his findings were published in last Sunday's paper.
We have, in recent weeks, been receiving a number of emails complaining that we had mistranslated the speech. The truth is that I started out thinking that we might have a correction, we might have some kind of clarification. We should find out if, in fact, we mistranslated it. And I was preparing simply an internal document. And then, having gone through it over a period of days, we decided that it was worth sharing with all of our readers.
Probably a lot of the critical letter writers were deriving their information from Juan Cole, a history professor in Michigan who authors a widely read blog about Middle East politics and history. Now, Cole has argued that the idiom "wipe off the map" doesn't even exist in Persian, and that in that speech, Ahmadinejad was actually citing a remark by Ayatollah Khomeini years ago, and that Ayatollah Khomeini's remark was, "This regime occupying Jerusalem must vanish from the page of time."
It turned out that Khomeini's original phrase was so metaphorical and abstract that at the time, translators didn't know what to do with it and ended up calling it map. It had ended up staying in the kind of Iranian lexicon that way. And at military parades in Tehran across all these 28 years or so since the revolution, death to Israel, death to America, wipe both off the map are pretty common things. So in brief, what happened is that I asked Nazila to go back to the original Khomeini quote. And what she found was that Ahmadinejad had, in fact, slightly misquoted Khomeini and had used a slightly different phrase so that the word map seemed better translated in Ahmadinejad's words as time or pages of time. But one of the central points that Juan Cole was making was that the word wipe or wipe off or wipe away was an aggressive word, and that really disappear is a better translation of the Persian both by Khomeini and by Ahmadinejad.
Have any officials in Iran, to your knowledge, actually disputed the map-wiping translation of Ahmadinejad's remark?
No. I mean, to the contrary. In fact, the president's official website, if you go to it in English, it uses the term wipe away and wipe off. And when the foreign minister was questioned about this in Brussels months after the speech, he didn't dispute the translation. He simply said, look, we're not talking about, you know, going to war anyway. You can't wipe a country off the map. It's just a question of objecting to and opposing this particular state and country in the Middle East.
So you can oppose the existence of a country, but that doesn't necessarily imply that you're ready to destroy it.
Well, this is exactly the issue, Brooke. I think that a simple analogy might be that if I said to you, I wish you were dead, it's not the same thing as my saying to you, I am going to kill you. There was a similar dispute in the beginning of the Cold War when Khrushchev said, we will bury you. Now, I'm not saying that it was mistranslated, but there were those who argued that the Russian, in fact, was closer to, I will attend your funeral, or I will be there at your burial, and that it wasn't quite the attack that it seemed to be to Americans at the time.
So, after your examination, you stand by the translation.
Yes.
But do you think it's okay for this phrase to become a shorthand to describe Ahmadinejad and what he stands for in the media?
Well, in the case of Ahmadinejad, I don't think that is an inappropriate stand-in for his general set of remarks or Iran's policy toward Israel. It does support, both with money and arms, Islamic Jihad in Palestine as well as Hezbollah in Lebanon. Both are groups that have engaged in terrorist attacks against Israelis. And he is, of course, equally famously continued to question the reality of the Holocaust. And so, you know, he does not speak in isolation. I mean, obviously, there's another point here, which is that the reason this feels so fresh and so raw as an issue is that there are those who argue that we misinterpreted Iraq's intentions or plans before going to war with Iraq. I'm not making that argument. I'm just simply saying that there are those who argued it, and they want to draw an analogy with what's going on with Iran. And it seems to me, whatever argument you want to make, you need to know the facts. And so I looked into the facts, and these are as I see them with regard to his words.
All right. Ethan, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Ethan Bronner is deputy foreign editor for The New York Times.
A cumulative audience of more than 32 billion is expected at some point to watch the World Cup. And the astounding popularity of these games is changing global politics, at least until the July 9th finals. North Koreans are watching South Koreans for the first time, strengthening their common identity. Israelis and Palestinians rose up as one to protest the high cost of the telecasts. And we Americans? Apparently most of us are left cold by the World Cup, despite the strenuous, if occasionally tone-deaf, efforts of our sports media. Franklin Foer, editor of The New Republic and author of How Soccer Explains the World, an Unlikely Theory of Globalization, says the way games are covered speaks volumes about each nation's particular obsessions.
In England, there's still, I think, this kind of residual sense of imperialism, actually, in the coverage, or rather of imperial greatness. There's this expectation that England, no matter the players that they're actually fielding on the team, are going to achieve great success in a tournament. And so the press invests all this effort into hyping the English team and their successes. If you look at the Italian press, there's this incredible focus on refereeing. And there's this kind of vague sense of conspiracy, which is, I would argue, broadly reflective of lots of parts of Italian culture and society where historically authority has been incredibly diffuse. And these sorts of conspiracies have actually been quite real given the influence of the mafia in the country.
And by the way, the succession of refereeing scandals in Italy and throughout Europe, I mean, it's not utter paranoia.
One of my favorite television shows around the world is a show called Il Processo in Italy, which means the trial. And literally, there's a panel of journalists and inevitably one leggy woman with a dress with a slit up to her belly button who decide if the referee has been judicious in handing out punishment or failing to hand out punishment. And you have these clips of players falling to the ground or getting tripped that are played in super slow motion over and over again and are debated. And there's always this whiff of conspiracy within this discussion that somebody is paying off somebody to get these charges, that the referees can't possibly be acting in the best interest of the game. It is the single most delightful spectacle.
Now, I guess in some countries, the way the press covers soccer reflects not so much national values so much as the way the press operates. I'm thinking of Brazil, which has been sort of notoriously hands-off on the subject of corruption that has riven the sport.
That's right. In Brazil, there was a congressional investigation, and what it uncovered was that there was this incredibly cozy relationship between the federation that runs Brazilian soccer and the press that covers it, that when the press went to the 1998 and 94 World Cups, their way was paid by the Brazilian Federation, and they were taking on these extravagant shopping trips along with their wives. And the effect is that corruption in Brazilian soccer never really gets fully exposed. In fact, there's a term of art for the guys who run the Brazilian game who are corrupt. They're called the cartolas, which means the top hats. And everybody knows that the cartolas rule with a corrupt hand, yet there's been very little done ever to dislodge them. And I think that the main reason that there's been inaction is that the press has never really crusaded against them.
I just want to come back to the United States for a moment and talk about the games as they are being televised here, using as a color commentator not a European or Asian or South American soccer expert, but in fact an American baseball announcer sort of specially trained for the duty.
Among soccer fans, there's a broad sense that ESPN and the Disney company must hate soccer because they field commentators who seem to know very little about the game, who don't announce the game using any of the conventions that the rest of the world uses. And a lot of people turn to the Spanish networks to watch the games, even if they don't speak Spanish themselves, merely to avoid the annoying commentary offered by the ESPN ABC announcers.
Well, give me an example of something that's particularly irritating.
Well, there are these cliches that they seize upon. They'll talk tirelessly about soccer's stopping a civil war in Ivory Coast. They'll repeat this ad nauseum. They speak in hyperbole about players and about the game, so that if there's a player like Ronaldinho who has an incredible reputation, they'll just say that he's fantastic over and over again without adding any sort of depth to that. Those are the superficial things. What really I think is irksome is that they insist on using baseball and basketball as a metaphor for making sense of the rules. They'll misdescribe goal kicks as penalty kicks. And then there's just kind of a broader lack of grasp of the English language that I think offends soccer fans, describing how the game is turned around 360 degrees when they mean 180 degrees. And maybe it's the snobbery of soccer fans that we are so irked and upset by all this.
Well, Frank, thank you once again.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Franklin Foer is author of How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization. Meanwhile, Budweiser ads running in England take pleasure in the American soccer fans' pain.
Hi, I'm Brad Lascarbo.
And I'm Hal Butchgrass.
We've come all the way from the U.S. of A. to the quaint town of Germany to bring you all the kicks, tackles, and field goals of the 2006 FIFA World Cup.
Coming up, reality bites a public radio station in Spokane when Comedy Central comes to town.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Does the overwhelming reliance on white male news sources merely reflect the distribution of American political and economic power, or perpetuate it? The correct answer may be a little bit of both. So then the question is, what to do about it? Over the past 20 years, with varying degrees of diligence, some news outlets have made an effort to bypass the usual suspects by seeking women or minority experts and other commentators. Often called the Rainbow Rolodex, the process is aimed at broadening the journalist's worldview. but to others it smacks of tokenism. When the staff of the Detroit Free Press was told last week by management to contribute to such a Rolodex, some in the newsroom objected. Paul Anger is editor of The Freep, and he joins us now. Paul, welcome to OTM.
Well, Bob, thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
You've said that the staff is almost totally on board. Tell me about the holdouts.
There were some staff members who raised some of the issues that you raised in your introduction. Is it tokenism? Will we be using sources that maybe aren't as up-to-date or credible in some stories at the expense of getting a range of sources? And we've answered those questions. And I think the vast majority of the staff understands that it's the right thing to do for readers. It's the right thing to do for us as a business to let all sorts of people see themselves reflected in the Detroit Free Press.
Now, the question about whether this will bring into the paper kind of second-tier sources has some familiar echoes. I'd be interested in knowing how the same people who raised that issue regard, for instance, affirmative action, because it strikes me that the development of a rainbow Rolodex is really nothing but journalistic affirmative action.
Here's the thing, Bob. Historically, the media have had a challenge in being inclusive, and you're really not doing your job as an individual at a newspaper unless you really are in touch with the whole community. I don't know that that equates to affirmative action. I'm not sure it does, but I can tell you this, that in a range of different kinds of stories, you're liable to see, over time, a range of different kind of people represented.
Now, I understand you didn't run a story or a series of ads saying, coming soon, the more inclusive Detroit Free Press, but this has been written about in the press. We saw a story in the New York Times about it, for example. Have you had any reaction from, for example, the black community in Detroit to your decision?
No, there hasn't been any reaction. And I really believe that one of the reasons for that is that the city of Detroit is certainly overwhelmingly African American. And I think that the folks in the city understand that the Free Press is committed to covering them in ways that are inclusive and comprehensive. And we don't just drop in for the crime on the corner. That we're there to cover a range in the city of Detroit and also over our whole metro area, which is almost 5 million people.
It's not immediately obvious to the reader necessarily that the person you're quoting is black or Hispanic or what have you. Will you be able to resist the temptation not to suddenly run a lot more photos of the people you're quoting in order to let the world know how diverse you've become?
We would not run a picture of somebody just to trumpet the fact that we have somebody of color. The thing you want to be careful of is that you don't somehow turn this into something that is sort of visible in a way that seems artificial. You don't want to do that. So we have to ask ourselves, and this is a hypothetical for you, is there an environmental scientist at Wayne State University who is a person of color who can comment on the state of the Great Lakes and the pollution and some of the predator fish that are coming into the Great Lakes and causing problems? This needs to be a seamless thing where we make sure that we have a range of sources on a range of topics where people of color will be represented.
Paul, thank you so much.
Okay, well, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Paul Anger is the editor of the Detroit Free Press. As we just heard, his paper's effort relies on its reporters to find sources of color. But an experiment now underway in our world of public radio aims to cast the net far wider. Minnesota Public Radio and its affiliated programs in Los Angeles are appealing directly to their listeners. For example, here's a pitch that followed a story about the switchover to Medicare's so-called Part D prescription plan.
Is the switchover affecting you or someone you know? If so, we want to hear your story. Go to MinnesotaPublicRadio.org and under the shortcuts menu, choose Medicare Part D. Your insight on this helps us cover the story better.
The news outlets ask listeners to share what they know. They ask them for their names, bios, and phone numbers, and they're getting them. Minnesota Public Radio and American Public Media have already amassed a database of almost 19,000 potential sources on a variety of stories, cataloged by profession, expertise, and experience. The project, known as Public Insight Journalism, is headed by Minnesota Public Radio Managing Director of News, Michael Scholar. He says the database proved vital for a recent story on the gap between white and minority student scores on standardized tests.
We've gathered people for that particular story by getting students, teachers, curriculum developers, school administrators, education activists into a network. And now when we've got a story about another issue, say curriculum standards in the Minnesota public schools, we can go to the people who we think are likely to have expertise on that. And what we get is a range of voices and perspectives that we wouldn't get by simply going to the chief curriculum developer, kind of the usual suspects that a reporter goes after on a story.
But it's still a top-down way of going after a story. You've decided you're interested in curriculum standards, so you start scouring your database to find out who there can give you some insight. But what about story suggestions themselves?
Well, that's the more sophisticated use of public insight journalism and the more powerful use of it. And we've been making inroads there. Increasingly, we're actually going out into communities around the region, and we're having meetings where we'll invite 50, 60, 70 people. And we ask questions like, what have you talked about around your dinner table in the last week? What's going on in your community? Are you feeling more financially insecure than before? Tell us about your experience. And we get surprised a lot of the time. That story that I just talked about ended up immediately getting a few dozen responses from people telling us about breaking into their 401k plans to pay medical expenses, folks who told us that they were running credit card debt for the first time in their lives. It wasn't enough for a story, but it got us beginning to look at numbers like mortgage defaults, credit card debt in the state, looking at kind of indicators that there might be a continuing problem for a lot of middle-class folks in the economic recovery. Once we had gathered that information, we put that together with the anecdotes we were hearing, and we were able to pull together a story about a new phenomena that was under our radar screen. By doing those things, we're actually setting our own news agenda that's less dependent on the people that are constantly trying to manage the media's agenda. Politicians, corporate executives, official spokespeople for organizations, they've gotten very, very good in the last decade at setting our agenda for us, much better than we've gotten at cutting through the spin, I think.
This is going to be stunning news for most of our listeners, but reporters are often motivated, among other things, by vanity and ego. And among the things that we are proud of is our ability to ferret out stories. Is there anyone in your newsroom who reacted badly to reporting by dossier?
Well, we had huge skepticism when we started. And I understand that. You know, the question in the newsroom was, why are we working differently? You know, we're doing fine the way we are. Hell, I've got my contacts. I've got my golden Rolodex of people. All you're really doing is making more work for me because now you want me to consider all these extra potential sources for a story. What we found over time, though, is as reporters have tried it out, they found that often it can be faster because, you know, they can have a story idea that they want to begin on now, and within an hour or two, we can have a few or a dozen sources that they wouldn't have found on their own that they can start mining. The people who really champion it say, if I want to find someone who's lived through a particular social problem, say, you know, mental illness in an adolescent, instead of going to an activist group and asking them for one of their poster children, I can find those folks through this network. And I'm less concerned that they're on message and that they are fully representative of this problem or issue.
In order to be able to do this, you have had to amass a quite substantial database of individuals' hopes, dreams, desires, fears, concerns, which is pretty intimate information. I gather you're taking great care to make sure that none of this material falls into the wrong hands?
We promise people confidentiality. We say nothing that you tell us will go on the air or on the web without your explicit permission. And even within the newsroom, we've limited access to just a few journalists that we call public insight analysts who tend to work the database, who know how to write queries to get people to open up and share their stories and know that the confidence will be kept.
Over the past number of years, we've heard a lot about citizen journalism, including predictions that news organizations would become irrelevant and that the blogosphere has changed everything, giving the individual a voice and the ability to essentially replace outside filters who determine what constitutes news. How is this different from that vision of the future?
most of the people involved in citizen journalism basically feel that old mainstream media are dead and that what we need to do is replace it by enabling regular people who are non-reporters to rise up and share what they know and become reporters. Our approach is really to say mainstream media is good. The people who practice it are smart. They've got great skills. What we need to do is enable them to connect much more deeply with the knowledge of the public, the bigger brain of the public. I think that this is kind of the way that mainstream media can ensure that they stay relevant and have a role that people respect and will trust.
Well, Michael, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
Michael Scholer is Managing Director of News at Minnesota Public Radio, American Public Media, and the director of the brand new Center for Innovation in Journalism.
Comedy Central's latest fake news concoction called Dog Bites Man has made its debut. The improv-based show follows a fictional Spokane, Washington news team as they interact with real-life subjects, sources, and experts. Their motto? News travels fast, unless there's traffic. In this week's episode, the news division went for sensitivity training.
I don't know why we need a racial sensitivity seminar. We're all pretty sensitive.
Well, evidently there was a complaint filed against us. Maybe because we didn't celebrate Ramadan or something.
We stayed in a Ramadan once in Seattle.
That's Ramada Inn, Alan.
The show has been well received, except maybe by some of the real-life newsmen and women of Spokane who may have a sense of humor, but don't want anyone confusing them for the impersonators in their midst. Spokane Public Radio's Janine Jorgensen wrote to us with her own particular beef.
The news organization has the call letters KHBX. We are KPBX. Secondly, our afternoon news host is Tom Bacon. Their news anchor is Kevin Beacon.
Not only that, you sent me the photos of your news team, and I see the photo of their news team, and you pointed out that there is a certain general resemblance, and I have to say I agree. So what did you do?
I had to bring it to the attention of Comedy Central. I said, what is going on? Why did you use the letters KHBX for a Spokane news team? Was it really a random grouping of letters? They have been blurring the lines between television, entertainment, and news. They're arranging interviews with organizations and people. They set up a panel discussion, and then they started asking inappropriate questions. They set up these interviews saying that they were a real news team in Spokane. We know this is supposed to be a comedy show, and sure, we're amused by the coincidences, but there's a little part of us that is hoping that nobody thinks that this is really a Spokane news group and that it certainly isn't Spokane Public Broadcasting.
Fair enough. So you wrote to Comedy Central. Did they write back to you?
All that they told me was that the person who could answer that question of why they used KHBX was in London and so couldn't answer our question at the moment.
Well, we're going to work on getting an answer for you, Janine.
Thank you, Brooke. I appreciate it.
Janine Jorgensen is the marketing and web director at Spokane Public Radio. Dan Mazur is the executive producer of Dog Bites Man. We tracked him down in London. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Very exciting.
So you are aware of the fact that your fictional letters KHBX are very close to Spokane's real public radio station call letters, KPBX?
I literally was made aware of that 7 days ago. I had no clue whatsoever. It's an unfortunate yet happy coincidence.
Happy for you, perhaps. You know, KPBX has a bit of a beef with you guys because they're afraid that when they go out to do their legitimate news reports, the people that they encounter may think it's you and they'll head for the hills.
Well, they can just do opinion pieces. It's fine. They can just talk about the news. It's fine. And also, they should be happy that we've actually been pretty much banned from the environs of Spokane by the Spokane Tourist Board. So,
really? They're not going to let you do taping in the city?
No. Mean-spirited Spokane Tourist Board have said that we're besmirching their town's good name.
So where are you going to tape?
Whatever's next door to Spokane.
So, Dan, other than the city of Spokane itself, what's the biggest hurdle you've had to overcome in producing this show?
It's a very unique concept, the show, that hasn't really been tried before. My background is I was the executive producer and sort of co-creator of the Ali G show. Obviously, that was all about kind of fake interviews. So, you know, I have my share of people chasing me already, whether it be the FBI or the CIA or the Department of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, all of whom I've kind of set up in the past. I'm surprised they even let me back in the country initially to film this series, let alone actually the people that we encountered while we were doing it. But what we have to do is we're kind of intertwining real people into our fake plot. So the only actors in it are our four crew from KHBX, and everybody else is the unwitting cast member, if you like, of our sitcom. And so when you're sitting in a writing room and coming up with a plot, you sort of bank on people responding in the way you expect them to respond in order to propel your narrative and your plot forward. And sometimes very, very selfishly, they refuse to comply with what you've imagined in your writing room. And you have to kind of hurriedly reinvigorate your narrative and your plot to fit around their nuisance, strange answers.
I think we've talked to you before about the problem of what happens when your program, which involves unwitting participants, becomes too well known. And suddenly those people become less and less available to you.
That really is a problem. And obviously that the shelf life of Ali G was severely compromised by that. So, you know, I'm hoping that we're nowhere near as popular or as successful as my previous thing. So therefore I can carry on going for longer. That, you know, that's the dream.
Dan Mazur is the executive producer of Comedy Central's new show, Dog Bites Man. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brooke.
Up next, what if they declared a National Awareness Month and nobody was aware?
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We're devoting this part of the show to awareness, which nearly everyone wants to raise about something. The direct approach is to write up the chosen issue in a press release and hope the media respond. But that's a chancy proposition at best, so other avenues are explored. Take soap operas. They engage the hearts and minds of millions. In the mid-1960s, Miguel Subito was just a Mexican TV scriptwriter, grinding out cliffhangers for the hugely popular primetime soaps called telenovelas. But suddenly, a progressive Peruvian telenovela, Simple Maria, became a national craze, pulling more viewers than even the last game of the World Cup. Simple Maria defied stereotype by taking control of her own destiny. And in her storyline, Subito saw a chance to instruct and inspire millions. Thus, the Subito Method was born. Since the 1970s, Subito's recipe has been exported around the globe, and several organizations have become torchbearers. Hannah Rosen wrote about Subito for The New Yorker, and she joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what is the Subito method, and how is it different from the standard method of creating a telenovela?
Well, women in Latin America at a certain level in the standard telenovela, there's no idea that they should break out of the societal mode. Usually it's a woman and visited upon her all sorts of tragedies and amnesia and infidelity. And then she just kind of drifts back into that cycle again, into sort of another doomed marriage and, you know, looks for her redemption and romance. A Subito telenovela completely subverts that formula. While not losing the central romance and titillation of a telenovela, it tries to have one of the characters, at least, break out of those traditional social roles. And it's the character who people are supposed to identify with. So it's a character of lower class who looks like everyone and isn't sort of a blonde bombshell or something like that.
How well have these stories translated from country to country? I mean, you wrote about Subito's efforts in India, Burma, Nepal. What worked and what didn't?
Well, that's a lesson that's come hard to them, and it's been a slow trial and error process of trying to get a local voice, but not a local voice that's completely reflecting all the local values. So actually, they have to do a lot of specific training country to country, which a group, Population Communications International, which I wrote about, that's one of the things they do, is do trainings for screenwriters and radio producers.
Tell me about Population Communications International.
PCI, as it calls itself, was started to work on population control around the world, and then telenovelas became its specialty, and it gets its funding from all sorts of places, sometimes from the U.S. government, sometimes from the U.N., and sometimes from small organizations locally.
I think the thing that struck me the most is the demonstrable impact of Subito's telenovelas on people's behavior all around the world. And I guess one of the clearest examples involved a radio telenovela in Tanzania.
Yes, Tanzania was one of the most interesting studies they did because they cut off a certain area of the country from radio transmission for 2 years and measured the difference in how many people, for example, used family planning or took AIDS drugs in the section of the country that did not have the program and the sections that did.
So how big was the difference from region to region?
There was bigger differences in attitudes. So there was sort of 60% differences in attitudes in terms of acceptability of HIV testing and acceptability of certain ideas about children and what children represented. And then in terms of actual behavior, it was on the order of sort of 25-30% in terms of whether people actually requested certain drugs, requested tests, or requested certain forms of birth control.
And did it ever run into conflict with the local church or the local government?
Yes, all the time. And in Mexico, it still does. I mean, Subito talks and writes about how he had to handle the church's position very delicately and got the church to agree to have a priest appear at the end of every one of his programs. These telenovelas do not aim to be radical because they have to work with governments, because a lot of local television is government controlled. They stay within the rules, but that doesn't mean they don't upset people. In Latin America, they're very controversial, wherever the church is powerful. Even in South Africa, they had a very hard time. In China, putting on a show about AIDS took a lot of effort and work and negotiation with the local health agencies.
And they don't only have to work with governments, they also have to work with audiences who are going to get turned off by stuff that seems too didactic or educational.
Yes. At the training that I attended in Mexico, that was a big part of the lesson, because these are not script writers by nature. These are, you know, a lot of these people are social workers and NGO people. And they went over with them the basics of storytelling and dramatic stories.
Your piece opens with them working out the plot of what happens to a young rape victim. You know, should she develop VD? Should she be abused by the hospital staff? Should she kill herself? And then finally, somebody came in and said, oh, God, she's suffered enough.
Well, that was an amazing moment for me because that's when I realized the program was working, because here you have these social workers who in any other context, they would be trying to help her and feeling sorry for her. And here they were coming up with fresh and better torments. And in the end, this woman had to come in and kind of calm them down and say, hey, listen, the Sabido point is that the person who behaves well, she does use the help of social workers. She doesn't kind of hide out in shame. She has to be rewarded for that good behavior.
Now, we think of soap operas as daytime programming here, but in Latin America and many places around the world, it's in prime time. They have a lot of male viewers. Are there any concessions made to the male viewer to keep them tuned in?
Yes, hugely. This was one thing that they realized kind of late in the process, because it started, as I said, as a sort of women rights, population control. They realized that in many of the countries they were working, that was a completely pointless way to go about it, because in fact, the men made all the decisions. And in the case of Nepal, which I wrote about, it was the men and the mother-in-laws. To pitch a show to women was completely pointless, because they had no power in that particular rural society to decide if they were going to go to the doctor or if the family was going to save money or how much they were going to work. And so they completely rewrote shows in certain countries. And I've seen a few, like in Indonesia and Nepal, where they're completely aimed towards men. So it's like an action show in the beginning. The message comes across at the end, but the show is structured as a show aimed at men.
You mentioned in your piece that the next step for Population Communications International is possibly a collaboration with U.S. Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, Karen Hughes, our hearts and minds czar. So what do you know about this collaboration?
This collaboration is driven by a man named Sonny Fox. He invited Karen Hughes to be the keynote speaker at the last PCI conference, and she had to cancel at the last minute. But he does kind of send scripts and is dialoguing, if that's a word, with various people in the State Department and American government to use these telenovelas to get at our central international problem right now.
It's hard to imagine an Arab language soap opera which casts America in a positive light these days, but maybe that's just a failure of my imagination.
Here's my scenario for the perfect Arab telenovela. It would have to be Arab produced. So you'd have a doctor who was an Arab, but born and educated in America. And he is sent over for some reason, let's say a scholarship to an Arab country, maybe Jordan. And he comes with all his arrogant American ways and he thinks he's going to a backward place and he's really condescending. And then one day as he's sitting working in his office, he's introduced to his new nurse. And the nurse comes in and you just sort of see her from the back and she's fairly covered up. And it turns out to be the daughter of a famous imam, a famous but somewhat progressive imam who lets his daughter work. And then the doctor looks up and she's absolutely beautiful. And you just pan onto her sort of beautiful, deep eyes. And you see the doctor just kind of freeze. And you know at that moment that he's going to fall in love with her. And then together they teach each other about each cultural ways.
Hannah, I think you've got a winner.
Thank you.
Hannah Rosen is a contributing writer to The New Yorker. Here in America, those seeking to raise awareness still focus on the news media to get out the word. They know that reporters hanker for news pegs to hang their stories on. So aspiring awareness raisers try to seduce them with the calendar, as Bob explains.
Edgar Allan Poe said it best. At midnight in the month of June, I stand beneath the mystic moon and contemplate the cruel unfairness of scleroderma unawareness. Okay, Poe didn't actually write that second part, but surely he would have if he weren't one of the majority of Americans woefully ill-informed on autoimmune disease, because awareness is a prerequisite for action, and June is indeed National Scleroderma Awareness Month. This is not to be confused with festivities surrounding other autoimmune nightmares, such as Multiple Sclerosis Awareness Month, which is March, Lupus Awareness Month, which is October, Arthritis Awareness Month, May, or Psoriasis Awareness Month, also October. Or maybe Poe wouldn't have found a life-threatening disease of the connective tissue fitting to wax poetic about. No problem. June is also Myasthenia Gravis Awareness Month, National Aphasia Awareness Month, National Cervical Cancer Awareness Month, Fireworks Safety Month, and Host Month for Headache Awareness Week, Dystonia Awareness Week, and Helen Keller Deaf-Blind Awareness Week. Yes, this is a big country, and there are many scourges of which to be aware.
You know, there are some awareness weeks where I look at the disease and I think, I'm not even sure I've ever heard of that.
Jennifer Barrett is health editor for Newsweek magazine online.
It does prompt me to do a little research in it. So I think in some cases, it sort of puts it on your radar screen sometimes. It doesn't necessarily mean we're going to write about it right now, but it increases the awareness among the press.
Barrett articulates pretty much the best-case scenario for the ever-growing awareness industry, whose foot soldiers must battle other news, other diseases, general indifference, and in the case of June, also Potty Training Awareness Week and National Accordion Awareness Week to get Disease X on the national radar. The steward of these observances is Captain Penelope Royal, Director of the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion at the Department of Health and Human Services.
The calendar has grown a lot since we started this in 1984 when we had 43 observances for the whole year.
This year, the number is 213, not counting the dozens of observances not officially sanctioned by HHS. The sheer number is problematic, awareness-wise, because there remain only 12 months or 52 weeks to vie for the nation's disease attention. For instance, Royal scanned her calendar and alighted on May.
How about neurofibromatosis month?
Do you happen to know what that condition is?
If you'll let me look it up, I can do that. Here we go. Neurofibromatoses are genetic disorders of the nervous system that primarily affect the development and growth of neural cell tissues.
Well, now I know about this disease. What am I supposed to do about it?
Well, what is next? Are you going to call the organization and find out more about it? Are you going to write a check out to help them develop cures? Are you going to walk around your neighborhood and try to raise money for the group? Are you going to go to your child's school and promote awareness there? Are you going to schedule a physical examination for yourself?
The answer to all of these questions, depressingly, is no. She also might have added, are you going to devote a story to it? But the month of June is slipping away, and we media elites are inundated with disease reporting opportunities. Richard Perez Pena is Metro Health reporter for the New York Times.
You working on anything about firework safety?
Actually, no. Fireworks are illegal in New York.
Scleroderma?
Scleroderma, no.
Aphasia?
Nope.
Myasthenia gravis? Dystonia?
No.
Headache?
No.
Cancer?
No. If there are awareness weeks or months about all of those, I'm unaware of them.
Because, he explains, while people like him may be generally familiar with various disease observances, they do not regard them as particularly relevant news pegs. Partly because they are arbitrary, and partly because no self-respecting journalist wants the news agenda dictated by outsiders, thank you very much. But did Perez Pena just a few weeks ago not do a big Metrofront story about hepatitis B smack in the middle of May's Hepatitis Month?
I have a horrible admission to make. I had no idea that there was a Hepatitis Awareness Month. It never even occurred to me.
But it occurred to the Centers for Disease Control, which timed the release of the very study he was quoting for Hepatitis Awareness Month. Because, like Big Tobacco and Big Oil, Big Liver understands message management. And it understands the challenge of breaking through public ignorance and indifference. In a recent survey, the American Liver Foundation discovered that half the population doesn't realize that hepatitis is liver disease, and 90% believe that the major cause of liver damage is not infection, but alcohol abuse. Fred Thompson is president of the Liver Foundation.
The liver community has done a very bad job of focusing public attention on what liver disease actually is, exacerbated by the fact that there are over 100 different diseases, and many of those have their own little advocacy group. So there's a lot of fragmentation, and the liver community would be well served by bringing these various disparate factions together.
Easier for some organizations than for others. The Breast Cancer Pink Ribbon campaign has captured the imagination of millions. Likewise, Lance Armstrong's yellow wristbands. And colon cancer awareness got a boost when Katie Couric's husband died of the disease.
Liver was kind of just sitting back there while the other organs stepped to the plate and quite honestly have moved to the fore. We've got some catching up to do.
Do you lay awake at night wishing that Paris Hilton will get hepatitis B?
Having a celebrity or somebody like a Paris Hilton, and she happened to have liver disease, and we could get her as a spokesperson, that would be probably very helpful. We all know what Katie Couric did for colon cancer. So we are hoping to find some celebrities.
God willing.
Yeah. God willing.
Relatively speaking, though, liver disease is still a marquee condition. Fred Thompson has it pretty easy next to Michael Beach, senior epidemiologist with the CDC's Division of Parasitic Diseases. Dr. Beach administers Recreational Water Illness Prevention Week.
This year, not as much pickup, but, you know, in past years, we've managed to make it on the morning TV shows and that sort of thing on the national networks.
Remarkably, despite the native unsexiness of swimming pool hygiene, Beach's office has generated millions of web page views. But the fecal matter awareness message is a work in progress.
We regularly have conversations about how can we make the message more tantalizing and still be able to be tasteful and go through an approval process.
Can you give me an idea of what's been rejected?
No.
This brings us to Dan Bollinger, executive director of the International Coalition for Genital Integrity, that is, the anti-circumcision lobby. How would you characterize the general state of American genital integrity awareness?
I think so many people are involved with the decision-making process. We're talking about millions a year, and certainly we need to have a million conversations about that.
Do you think there's a million conversations going on?
There are. Unfortunately, they tend to be rather short and curt, like, well, should we cut? Well, I guess so. Okay.
Yet, despite the press releases and emails, the public service announcements, and even an itsy-bitsy little march on Washington, the 2006 Genital Integrity Awareness Week came and went with barely a peep about it in the American media. And that is the cruelest cut of all. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Claire Peters and Noah Kuman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by Ciaobella Gelato, purveyors of all natural gelato and sorbet. Ciaobella is available nationwide at specialty food markets. More information at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.